Hello there again. My name is Kugonza Munyaka and welcome to the Citizenry Show. For this episode, episode 2 by the way, we get to talk about the feasibility of the East African community and what needs to be done to consolidate it to an even bigger East African Federation. But for our previous episode, we got to talk about internal democracy in Uganda's political parties, and you can catch that in episode 1. So, to understand the East African community, its gears and what graces them, we need to understand first its people, second its past and present conflicts or civil wars, thirdly the disputes between member states, fourth the economy of each country, and lastly what needs to be done to achieve the objectives for the formation of the EAC. Uganda, Tanzania and Kenya enjoy the longest regional integration, with the first one being formed in 1967 by then heads of state Jomo Kenyatta of Kenya, Apollo Milton Obote of Uganda and Julius Nyerere of Tanzania. The EAC was later on dissolved in 1977, and this was due because of the coming of a new regime in Uganda by Idi Amin, who was a hothead for Ugandan president, if you ask me, and we shall discuss this Amin effect extensively later on the show. The EAC was then later re-established on 14th March 1996 by then heads of state Daniel Arap Moi of Kenya, Yoweri Kaguta Museveni of Uganda and Benjamin Mkapa of Tanzania, with the main objectives being harmonizing tariffs and custom regimes, free movement of people and improving regional infrastructure. And all these, you can see, were meant for trade purposes. Rwanda and Burundi became full members on 18th June 2007, with South Sudan following suit on 16th April 2016, that making the 6 EAC country member bloc to date. These countries sit on a land area of 2.5 million square kilometers and have a total population of 177 million people as of 2018. And now, that is a small population if you appreciate what a huge population does for trade in terms of market and what have you. And if you move in the east, northeast border of Kenya, there is Ethiopia. Now, this Ethiopia, a single country, had a population of 106 million people in 2016. Now, the EAC, which is a bloc, has 177 million people, and Ethiopia, a single country, in 2016 had 106 million people. Now you can see the difference. But the projections put a combined population of the EAC countries at 890 million people by the year 2050. The societies in the EAC are interconnected, with tribes crossing borders into other countries. And there are three major language categories spoken by these societies, namely the Niger-Congo languages of the Bantu group, and these are the most widely spoken languages. And among these include Kikuyu in Kenya, Kinyarwanda in Rwanda, Rutoro in Uganda, Kirundi in Burundi, Kisukumu in Tanzania, and so many others. Swahili is another category of languages spoken, and it has about 80 million speakers who use it as a first or second language. It is also a trade language in the EAC, and it has an official status in Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. The Nilotic languages are the other category, and this includes Luo, Kalenjin, Maasai, and Nor. The Luo live in South Sudan, namely the Nor. The Luo are in southern Kenya and northern Tanzania, and here they are called the Doluo. They are Luo in northern Uganda and Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo too are Luo. The Maasai, who live in northern Tanzania and central and south Kenya, are also Luo, and these are 1.5 native million speakers as of the 2009 census. Now, in spite of being that connected by ancestry, the Great Lakes region has faced several civil wars and conflicts, not forgetting genocides. In fact, it is only Tanzania that has enjoyed a stable government since independence. Burundi, Rwanda, and Uganda have each faced instability and ethnic conflicts since independence, and Kenya has relatively to been stable. Now, let's talk about the conflicts, and key emphasis will be placed on those that have happened when these states are part of the EAC, and those conflicts that we've seen the EAC member states participate in. And let's start with Burundi. The Burundi civil war and the genocide of 1993 to 2005, and this led to the rise of President Pierre Nkurunziza, and the Rwandan genocide of 1994 led to the rise of President Paul Kagame. These two events were attributed to the long-standing ethnic division between the Hutu and the Tutsi groups in both Burundi and Rwanda. The total number of casualties in the Burundi genocide was never established, but the estimates of the Tutsi genocides and the reprisals on Hutu together are said to exceed 100,000 people, while refugees fled to the neighboring Tanzania and Rwanda. The Hutu insurgents received support from Tanzania and Zaire, as both countries allowed the rebels to set up bases in their territories from where they could launch raids into Burundi. And at that moment, Tanzania showed her hand by directly participating in the fight to dispose of a government in a sister state. And that's not the first time it's doing that, as it did so in 1979, as we shall see later on. The Congo effect is also seen vividly here, as Mobutu Sese Seko of Zaire, who believed that he could gain political leverage by harboring Hutu militants and refugees, and he hoped they would suppress the anti-Mobutu groups in Zaire too. He also wanted to be seen by the international community as a leader who could resolve the Great Lakes refugee crisis, a classic textbook trick for our leaders here. But what worsened the already bad situation in Burundi and Rwanda was the plane carrying both Burundian and Rwandan President Cyprien Ntaryamira and Juvenal Habyarimana respectively, which was shot down on the 6th of April 1994. Now, more conflicts and violence brewed in Burundi, while in the neighboring Rwanda, this sparked off the famous Rwandan genocide, which killed about 500,000 to 1 million people in just 5 days. Now, Tanzania has been playing, and it played a huge role in the stabilizing of these two countries by mediating peace talks in both countries, with the signing of the Arusha Accords in 1993 for Rwanda and 2002 for Burundi. We also see Uganda playing a role in Rwanda, but Uganda's role was more of a destabilizing move, as the RPF rebels, first their leader Rugema, and then after Paul Kagame, who took command later, had deep roots in the NRA, which had captured state power in Uganda in 1986. Now, this Rugema was killed on the second day of battle, and by the way, the RPF lost that battle to the Rwandan army, which was assisted by troops from France. And then Paul Kagame had to take command, but by that time Paul Kagame was in the US, where he was studying at the US Senior Staff and Command College in Fort Leavenworth. And now we get to see the Congo effect again, as Congo gave homage to the Hutu factions that were destabilizing Burundi and fighting the RPF government in Rwanda. And Kigali has always been suspicious of its opposition, as in 1995 they started supporting the Burundi government, and they repeatedly crossed into Burundi to attack Hutu refugee camps which were harboring rebels. And a year later after that, Rwanda, with the support of Uganda, launched the first Congo War, which led to the overthrow of Mobutu Sese Seko. We have seen how Rwanda in 1996 attacked a sovereign state and deposed of a president, but this wasn't the first time it's happened in the East African region. Tanzania did it in October 1978 in what was dubbed the Uganda-Tanzania War, which went on until January 1979. This war led to the overthrow of Idi Amin, then president of Uganda. This Amin had overthrown Obote Milton in 1971. Obote, after losing power and with the support of the Tanzanian government, launched a rebellion on Uganda in 1972, leading to a border clash and an eventual signing of an agreement stipulating that both Amin and Nyerere withdraw forces from the Uganda-Tanzanian border. But that didn't solve the tension between Uganda and Tanzania, as Amin began claiming that the Kagera Salient, which is, by the way, a stretch of Tanzanian land between the official border and River Kagera, Amin claimed that this Kagera Salient should be placed under Uganda's jurisdiction. And in October 1978, Ugandan forces began making incursions into Tanzania, and later that month, the Ugandan army launched an invasion, looting property and killing civilians. And now the Ugandan media was awash with announcements of the annexation of Kagera Salient. And only a month later, on the 2nd of November that very year, Nyerere declared war on Uganda, and the Tanzanian People Defense Forces launched a counter-offense and resecuring Kagera by January 1979. And in turn, the Tanzanian People's Defense Force occupied the Ugandan town of Mutukula, and this is when we say checkmate. Nyerere then mobilized Ugandan rebels led by Obote and Museveni to weaken the Amin regime. But Amin, being a hothead, failed to renounce his claims on Kagera, and this, coupled with the failure of the Organization of the African Union to condemn the invasion on Uganda further, encouraged Tanzania to occupy more towns in Uganda, that is Masaka and Imbara. The Tanzanian People Defense Forces in February 1979 started to clear away for Kampala, and that is when another African bigwig and an ally of Amin, Muammar Gaddafi, then president of Libya, dispatched several thousands in troops to Uganda to assist the Ugandan army. And this wasn't the only assistance Amin got, as the Palestinian Liberation Organization sent some guerrilla fighters to assist also. But with this foreign reinforcement, in March, the combined Uganda, Libya, and Palestine forces were defeated in a battle at Lukaya, and this further weakened the Ugandan army. And after that win, Nyerere sponsored a conference of Ugandan rebels and exiles in Moshi, which led to the unifying of the rebel groups, forming a bigger Ugandan National Liberation Front. And now, when this fell into Gaddafi's ears, he threatened to militarily intervene in the conflict on Amin's behalf. But all those were just threats, because in early April of that year, the Tanzanian People Defense Forces seized Entebbe Airport, inflicting heavy damage on the Libyan troops and destroying the Ugandan Air Force at the same time. Now, the Libyan forces fled, leaving Amin and his Ugandan army on their own. And on 10th of April, the Tanzanian People's Defense Force and the Ugandan National Liberation Front attacked Kampala, and Amin fled to exile. And then the Ugandan National Liberation Front set up a government, and that brought an end to the war. And Uganda has since gone into several coups and unstable governments, some even leading for 100 days or less. And all this stops in 1986 when the NRA revolution saw Yoweri Museveni become president. And he is, by the way, up to date. But in spite of Museveni managing to stay in power that long compared to his predecessors, he too has had the Lord's Resistance Army War to deal with for about 2.5 decades. And numerous peace talks were held, and they broke up. The Sudan effect also heavily affected the peace talks and prolonged the war, as the Sudanese government in Khartoum gave military support to the LRA as a retaliation against Ugandan government for supporting rebels in what would later become the South Sudan. There are many atrocities from this war. For example, the killing of several hundreds in Atiyak in 1995, the kidnapping of 139 schoolgirls in Aboke in 1996, and during that very period where they kidnapped the Aboke girls in the year 1996, there was a presidential election, and we saw a short-lived ceasefire as Kony hoped that Museveni would be defeated in that election. Well, jokes on you, Kony. This guy never loses elections. and after that, the election, the fighting resumed. Now, the NSSF has in 2006 estimated that the LRA abducted 25,000 children since the conflict started, with 1.7 million people in more than 200 IDPs in northern Uganda. Now, that's a big number. And from 2006 to 2008, a series of meetings were held in Juba between the LRA and the Ugandan government. And they were mediated by the South Sudanese separatist leader, Riek Machar. And a truce was signed on 26th August 2006. The LRA continued massive attacks in Congo and displaced as many as 320,000 Congolese by August 2009. And by March 2010, the LRA had killed over 1,600 Congolese, abducted more than 2,500 people. And by 2011, they had killed more than 2,300 people, abducted more than 3,000, and displaced over 400,000 people across the DRC, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic. And after all that commotion and back and forth and fighting, in March 2012, Uganda announced it would head a new four-nation African Union military force with 5,000 soldiers from the DRC, South Sudan, and the Central African Republic to hunt down Kony and the remnants of the LRA. After that, Kony was reported to be in Jama, Central African Republic, but forces pursuing the LRA withdrew in April 2013 after the Central African Republic government, guess what, was overthrown by the Seleka Coalition rebels. Kony has since never been captured, but it is believed that he is out of the East Africa. And one would like to think that was the end of war in East Africa, but no. Ethnic violence did spare the newly created South Sudan nation. This young East African nation has 64 tribes, with the Dinkas being the largest with 35% of the population, and they dominate the government. And the Nuer are the second largest. And that wouldn't be a problem, but after about two decades of conflict between militants in the south and the central government of Khartoum that saw South Sudan secede from Sudan, the region was awash with guns, and young men were armed or are still armed with high power weapons. And in 2007, a local organization said that 5,000 people were killed in cattle raids since 2011 in South Sudan. So, during the second Sudanese civil war, several factions of the SPLA split along ethnic lines and were funded by governments in Khartoum. In 2013, after the dismissal of Vice President Riek Machar and his entire cabinet, fighting between the Nuer and Dinka SPLA soldiers broke out in Juba in December, as President Kiir accused his vice president and 10 others of attempting a coup. Machar, of course, denied the allegations and he fled to lead the SPLM in a position. And fighting soon broke out between the SPLM and SPLM in opposition, igniting a civil war. And here we see Ugandan forces being deployed to fight along the South Sudanese government. And in January 2014, the first ceasefire agreement was reached while fighting was still going on in several areas, and several other ceasefire agreements have been signed. But in August 2015, a peace deal known as the Compromise Peace Agreement was signed. And later, after a year, in 2016, Machar returned and was reappointed vice president. But soon, fighting resumed and the SPLM in opposition fled Juba again, and Kiir replaced Machar with Taban Deng, which further split the opposition, and rebel infighting became a major part of the conflict. It was not until on 22nd February 2020, Kiir and Machar struck a unity deal and formed a coalition government. But about 400,000 people have died in that civil war as of April 2018. And so, you can see the trend of wars that have been going on. And for our sister country in the east, you know, Kenya, yeah, has been stable too since independence, despite the election crisis of 2007 to 2008, after President Mwai Kibaki was declared winner in an election conducted on 27th December 2007. Now, supporters of Kibaki's opponent, Raila Odinga, of the ODM, alleged electoral manipulation, and this was widely confirmed by international observers. And while the observers from the ESC in Kenya never issued a statement, and Raila Odinga then encouraged his supporters to engage in mass protests, which he announced on local televisions and radios in Mombasa, Eldoret, Kericho, Kisumu, Nakuru, and parts of Nairobi. And police would shoot hundreds of violent protesters on live television, and this further caused more violence to erupt. And more, this violence targeted the Kikuyu people living outside their traditional settlement areas, especially in the Rift Valley province. By January, the death toll was around 1,300 people, with up to 600,000 people displaced. Now, landlocked countries like Rwanda, Burundi, Uganda, and eastern parts of Congo suffered serious economic ramifications, as these countries depend heavily on Kenyan infrastructure, particularly the port of Mombasa, for import and export routes. And on 28th February 2008, Kibaki and Odinga finally signed a power sharing agreement, which established the office of the Prime Minister, and a coalition government was created, and it was sworn in on 17th of April. Now, I'd want to look at the causes of these conflicts and wars in the Great Lakes regions as being greatly caused by the unfairness in governance, and so some even say maybe the distribution of the national cake in particular states rather than these wars being based on ethnic differences, as most put it. But that doesn't mean that these wars most times don't exhibit ethnic divisions or fighting. But even though that is the case, they shouldn't be described as being ethnic wars. Now, all these conflicts and instabilities have greatly impacted the economy of each individual state, and also the ESC as a bloc. The ESC boasts a total GDP of US$193 billion, that is as of 2019, and relative to the world, the ESC has very low export levels. Intra-ESC trade remains at a low paltry of 20% compared with trade within other regional economic blocks, such as the South African Development Community, which stands at 58%, and the European Union at a high of 68%. Now, Tanzania is the biggest economy on the whole block, with Tanzania, according to the IMF, in 2019 had a total GDP of US$61 billion and a GDP per capita of US$1,172. And that puts them higher than any other EAC member. Tanzania has expanded rapidly due to having a strong tourism, telecommunications, and banking sector. And this year, the World Bank declared Tanzania to be a middle-income status country with a GDP per capita between US$1,006 to US$3,955. But according to the UN development program, recent growth in national economy has benefited very few, leaving out the majority of the population, as it is evidenced by the Global Hunger Index back in 2013 that ranked Tanzania as being worse than any other country in the EAC except Burundi. Tanzanians export as of 2018 were US dollars 5.7 billion and the imports were worth 10.9 billion, and that leaves a negative trade balance of US dollars 5.09 billion. Now, Tanzania's top five exports then in 2018 were gold, raw tobacco, raw copper, refined copper, and other furniture. And their top five export destinations were Rwanda, which was at only US dollars 667 million. It was followed by India, China, and then Uganda, which was not only US dollars 359 million, and lastly the DRC, which was at US dollars 310 million. Tanzania's top five imports were refined petroleum, palm oil, packaged medicaments, cars, and wheat, with the top five imports coming from China at a whopping US dollars 2.9 billion. This was followed by India at 1.62 billion, the UAE at US dollars 952 million, Saudi Arabia followed, and then South Africa came in last with US dollars 504 million. Now, Kenya, on the other side, being the second biggest economy as of 2020, had a GDP of US dollars 109 billion. And the GDP per capita of US dollars 2,296. But as of 2018, Kenya's biggest foreign exchange earner was tourism, which was then followed by agriculture. And the total number of arrivals of visitors was at 1,167%, with African tourism giving Kenya 1.6 billion US dollars. Now, most of Kenyan visitors come from USA, Uganda, Tanzania, Rwanda, and Burundi. And Kenya's biggest market also lies within her neighbors, as of 2020 of Uganda absorbed 9.9% and Tanzania absorbed 9.6% and DRC absorbed 4.2% of Kenyan goods. And as of 2018, Kenyan exports were at 6.6 billion US dollars and the imports were at 19.7 billion dollars. Now that leaves a negative trade balance of 13 billion US dollars. And the top five exports of Kenya were tea, cut flour, refined petroleum, coffee, and titanium. And their exports were basically to Uganda at 643 million, Pakistan, then US, then Netherlands, and then the UK. And their top five imports were refined petroleum, cars, packaged medicaments, palm oil, and hot rolled iron, while these imports came from countries like China, which the value was at 4.7 2 billion, then followed by India, then the USA, then Saudi Arabia and the UAE and Japan. And now all these values are in billions. They're in billions. So that is a lot of money. And Uganda then follows. Uganda in 2009 had a GDP of US dollars 30.8 billion. And the GDP per capita of 956 US dollars. Now, Uganda has a largely untapped reserves of crude oil and natural gas, and it is not surprising that it has not been tapped in yet. And the World Bank in 2012 listed Uganda to be one of the most heavily indebted poor countries with all that untapped crude oil reserves. Uganda heavily depends on Kenya to access the Indian Ocean seaport of Mombasa. And Uganda in turn also serves as an economic hub for the DRC, Rwanda, Burundi, and South Sudan. Tourism in Uganda is a huge foreign exchange earner. As of August 2013, it earned Uganda $1.88 billion, with three quarters of the Uganda's tourists coming from African countries, citing Kenya as the biggest source of tourists to Uganda, making up almost half of all arrivals into the country. As of 2018, Uganda's exports were US dollars 4.16 billion and the imports were 6.29 billion, and that left a negative trade balance of 2.14 billion US dollars. Now, Uganda's top five exports were gold, coffee, dried legumes, fish fillets, and maize. And these products went to the UAE, which contributed 1.68 billion. Kenya followed with 507 million US dollars, and South Sudan came in third with 301 million US dollars. Then the DRC came in with 202 million US dollars, and lastly, Rwanda absorbed 197 million US dollars. While Uganda's top imports have been, as of 2018, petroleum, gold, packaged medicaments, palm oil, and delivery trucks, and these came from countries like China, UAE, India, and Kenya, which was at 643 million, and then Saudi Arabia. Now, moving on, Rwanda in 2010 had a GDP of 11.1 billion US dollars and a GDP per capita of 873 US dollars. Tourism is the fastest growing sector and the leading foreign exchange earner, with that contributing 303 million as of 2014, just like any other country on the ESG, tourism brings in more money. And as of 2018, Rwanda's exports were at a total of 970 million, and imports were at 1.98 billion US dollars, and that left them with a negative trade balance of 1.01 billion US dollars. And now, Rwanda. Rwanda exports more of gold, niobium oils, coffee, tin oils, and tea, and they export these to the UAE, US, Thailand, Pakistan, and China. And while they import more of furniture, broadcasting equipment, baked goods, plastic warehouses, and pulley system. And their top five import destinations being Tanzania at $667 million, Uganda at $197 million, Kenya at $176 million, and China, and then Burundi, and then India. So Burundi is one of the poorest countries on the EAC, with their economy being funded basically by foreign aid, and this foreign aid contributes 4.2% of the national income, and as of 2019 it boosted a GDP of 3.5 billion and a GDP per capita of $310. Now, only 2% of the population hold bank accounts, and fewer than 0.5% use bank lending services, while only 4% of Burundians use microfinance services. Now, Burundi has only one airport, and most daily traffic comes from Kigali. And most of Burundi's imports are to the UAE, DRC, USA, Germany, and Pakistan. And most of her import destinations are Saudi Arabia, China, UAE, Kenya, and in India. Now, when we look at the newly added member of the UAE, which is South Sudan, it is one of the world's most underdeveloped countries with little existing infrastructure, and has the highest maternal mortality in female literacy as of 2011. And this comes despite them being the third largest oil reserve in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, oil reserve revenues serve 98% of the government's budget, with more than $8 billion in revenue, with China National Petroleum Corporation being the major investor in South Sudanese oil sector. And the IMF reported that South Sudan oil reserves would be halved by 2020, that is this year. And South Sudan has a debt with the US, UK, Germany, and France and Canada. Now, those countries fall under the Paris Club, and they owe South Sudan, and South Sudan, owes them $11 billion, and that is out of the debt that they have of $38 billion. Now, South Sudan trades more with countries like UAE, India, Pakistan, and Uganda being their top five exports destination. And their most highest earning export being petroleum, crude petroleum at $1.6 billion. Yes. And most of their imports come from Uganda, then that is worth $301 million, then the UAE, then Kenya, then China, and the USA. Now, this unfairness only to trade among member states of the EAC could be attributed to a number of factors, like one being the earlier conflicts and wars in individual countries, and as we have seen earlier, this creates an environment that is unsuitable for trade within those very countries and neighboring states. Secondly, you can attribute it to the new form of bickery, for lack of a better word, amongst member states like Rwanda and Uganda. And that is, by the way, still going on. That show between Rwanda and Uganda is still going on. And this bickering started in February 2019 when Rwanda closed her borders with Uganda after accusing Kampala of arbitrarily detaining Rwandan nationals and harboring rebels that want to overthrow the government in Kigali. And his accusation, Uganda clearly denies. Now, with Rwanda going as far as issuing travel advisory warnings to its citizens not to travel to Uganda, and now this affected both economies, as you could see, like most of Rwandan imported goods worth of $197 million were from Uganda, and that stopping that trade or slowing down that trade makes a huge dent in the EAC economy. And that's not the only country, because Kenya and Tanzania have two gone at each other during this COVID-19 pandemic, when the Tanzanian president Magufuli declared his country to be free of COVID-19 and SOPs therein were abandoned. Now, Kenyan authorities started in May this year to block Tanzanian truckers from crossing the Namanga frontier on grounds of lacking valid COVID-19 clearance certificates, and Tanzania in kind responded by doing the same to Kenyan truckers. Now, third brings to the frequent violation of the EAC Common Market Protocol, which requires member states to open up their borders to facilitate free movement of goods, labor, services, as well as capital. In 2018, Tanzania imposed a 25% import duty on Kenyan confectionery, claiming that it had used zero-rated industrial sugars to produce them. Kenya in turn banned Tanzanian tour vans from accessing Masai Mara National Reserve, arguing that Tanzania also had banned Kenyan operators from accessing the Serengeti National Park. Tanzania also in February last year imposed fresh quality verification standards on Kenyan products, as they cited that Kenya had breached a mutual agreement on the standards of goods traded within the region. And up to now, Dar es Salaam also remains opposed to issuance of work permits to Kenyan nationals in its territory. Now, all these issues, amongst others, have frequently violated the Common Market Protocol, and no consequences have been imposed by the EAC. The other factor that is hindering this trade is the infrastructure development in the member states of EAC is still lacking, as this region of 2.5 million square kilometers boasts road network of only about 250,000 miles of road network, and about 10% of these roads are the only ones that are paved. Now, how is this a problem? To answer that, almost 90% of road transport freight traffic, almost 90% of road transport is freight traffic. That is the movement of goods to market. And only four countries have rail network, with Rwanda and Burundi having not even a kilometer of rail. Now, the rest of the countries boast about 52 miles only. And this means this is one of the quickest means of transport compared to water and road. That's sad, isn't it? Now, if you thought that was bad, we only have 345 airports, and here we're also counting those with Maram runways. And it's no doubt that air transport is the quickest means, but for an economic block, we only have few airports. And the water transport is the least developed amongst these East African countries. Now, the other factor is our economies are majorly dependent on agriculture revenues, and most of the farming being subsistence farming. Take an example of Tanzania's economy in 2013. Agriculture contributed 24.5% of the GDP, and hence providing an 85% of exports, and it employed half of the national workforce. While Rwanda in 2014, 32.5% of the GDP was from agriculture. And as for Burundi, 50% of the GDP in 2017 came from agriculture, of which 90% of it is subsistence, and it employs over 90% of the population. So there is need to industrialize or commercialize agriculture in member states. There is also the unwillingness for integration of some leaders and other members of government in these EAC countries. For example, on 17th of September 2011, the Daily Nation quoted a South Sudanese member of parliament saying that while his government was eager to join the EAC, it would likely delay its membership over concerns that its economy was not sufficiently developed to compete with the EAC member states and would become a dumping ground for Kenya, Tanzania, and Ugandan exports. So this sort of mindset also hinders the prosperity as far as trade is concerned. And you can already tell that China and the UAE countries have already made the ESC a dumping ground, and yet we export less with them than we do with our neighbors. And I think the ESC, if the ESC is to develop as a bloc, the leaders that be at the ESC should enforce these trade agreements that all member states are signatory to, and should start checking all these governments and their shortcomings in terms of governance. Now, thank you for listening in, and I would like to hear from you. you can send in your thoughts, and it's from these thoughts that we get our next topics of discussion, and it's your thoughts that shape the society. Let's meet on the next episode. Adios.